or, like Vietnam, abolish all tariffs on U.S. goods and hope for a reprieve. Strategically, the tariffs put Southeast Asia and China in the same boat, with Beijing in a position to work out a new regional trade order with itself at the center. Weakening the economies of countries friendly to the U.S. and wary of China, and that includes Taiwan with a 32% tariff, doesn't jibe with Trump's China strategy. Some observers have speculated that Trump's heavy tariffs on China were designed to force Xi Jinping to the bargaining table at a summit meeting, where a new trade deal favorable to the U.S. could be worked out. But that was a sadly mistaken reading of Chinese thinking. A Chinese foreign ministry spokesman said last month that the Trump administration was, quote, weaponizing trade issues to contain and go after China. The spokesperson warned that a tariff war would, quote, hurt the one who launched it. Now China has followed through, imposing the same 34% tariff on U.S. exports that Trump imposed on China, plus restrictions on rare earth minerals exports and 11 companies that will no longer be able to do business in China. Trump can forget about a summit meeting with Xi anytime soon. What is particularly noticeable about this tariff war is that the Trump people have not indicated what their goal is or whether they have an endgame. Are the tariffs the opening move in an effort to bring foreign tariffs down? If so, does the administration want to negotiate tariff rates, or is it mainly interested in punishing countries with trade surpluses with the U.S.? Each country's trade relationship with the U.S. is different. Trump's team doesn't seem to accept that and act accordingly. Negotiating new trade deals would have been the normal way to proceed when trade deficits are believed to have become unsustainable. Trump will not retreat, however, no matter the cost to consumers and businesses. He'll justify the tariffs until the day he leaves office, in disgrace. I'm Mel Gertoff for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 8, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertoff. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Mike Moen, Tramel Gomes, Edwin J. Vieira, Antonia Gonzalez, and Dr. Anthony Leisowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
Welcome to Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gasco. Today, to celebrate the first independent episode of Coast Range Radio, we're going to try something new. So, the core project of this show, as I see it, is to inspire action in the face of the climate, social, and economic crises we face today. And usually that means highlighting the work of activists and organizers and specific campaigns and protests, hearing from elected officials, or learning about important research. But sometimes it's important to step back and place our work and ourselves in a larger context. And even amidst the relentless assaults we are currently facing, I think this is one of those times. So, I am thrilled to be joined by best-selling Oregon author John Larrison to talk about his transcendent new book, The Ancients. I'll leave it to John to describe the story of the ancients, but as we'll get into in this conversation, it's, among other things, to me, a deeply moving allegory on the climate crisis, deep time, and the resilience of life. More importantly, it is a thrilling and beautiful story, and I cannot recommend it highly enough. The Ancients is available online. You can go to johnlarison.com, and it is available at many local independent bookstores, which is, of course, where we obviously recommend that you shop if you can. And quick note, the new show email is coastrangeradio@gmail.com. Please reach out anytime with questions, thoughts, show ideas, whatever. Okay, John Larison, welcome to Coast Range Radio.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael. I've been looking forward to this.
Yeah, likewise. And I actually read The Ancients so quickly and a while ago that I had to go back and, or I should say I got to go back and reread it recently. And it was just as powerful the second time. I want to ask you what it's about from your perspective. I also want to ask you to read a passage from it.
Sure. Maybe I'll tell you how the book was born.
Sure.
And then I'll get to a read. Most of my books, you know, my previous books, Whiskey When We're Dry was my most recent before The Ancients. Those books are born from like a character or a voice. But this book was born from that feeling that I think we all have, this feeling of alarm about the future, especially the future of the climate, the environment, which of course becomes the story of everything in our lives. Like when the environment's struggling, everything is struggling, even our personal relationships, right? So I had that feeling that I think we all have. And I realized I had new kids at home, new babies. And I realized that I needed to get a handle on this feeling that I had. I couldn't let it sort of spin me out in the ways it had before I had kids. That began a 7-year project of thinking about climate change, researching climate change. And really, really from the first day of the book I had, that I began working on the book, I had two kind of hypotheses. One of them was that we are unable right now to hold the idea of climate change accurately. Science can tell us about the symptoms of climate change, but I don't think science can tell us about the root cause of climate change. And I'm going to argue, if you'll let me, that big oil is not the root cause of climate change, that there's actually something much bigger going on. And then, you know, number two, I feel like the nature that I know, you know, I was a fishing guide for a lot of years. As a kid, my parents made films for National Geographic. And so I spent, you know, 4 months of most years sort of embedded in other cultures, often indigenous cultures. And those experiences outdoors showed me just every day how resilient nature really is. And then when I get home and I'm inside my house and I'm reading the very best climate journalism written by the best writers who've done the most research, they're often talking about a nature that I don't understand. They're talking about a nature that is collapsing, that's failing. And that just doesn't square with the nature I know. So really, those were the feelings that this book was born from. Mm-hmm. And pretty quickly on, I realized that the story that I wanted to tell, that I needed to tell to really hold climate change in my mind, was a story that stepped outside of our own world and stepped outside of specifically the ideas of Western civilization that we're all walking in, swimming in right now. Science is made of Western civilization. You know, journalism is made of Western civilization. And I wanted a story that took readers from their world in Western civilization and brought them out of that to be able to look back at themselves from a new vantage point. I have come to believe, and I'll try to explain this, that really the core ideas underpinning Western civilization are the root cause of climate change, not big oil. Big oil is a symptom of bad stories we tell ourselves about our relationship between us and the world around us. I think we all know that the stories that we use to shape our reality and our relationship between ourselves and the world around us aren't quite accurate. I think we feel that, all of us. And I hope that this project sort of gave me a language to kind of make sense of that for myself and for other people.
Absolutely. These are a lot of the things that are rattling around in my brain that I'm grappling with. And you touched on a lot of points that actually I want to get into in a bit. So I appreciate you did a little foreshadowing there. So.
Yeah. And so I'll tell you briefly about the story now. It's kind of a big story, but it's been, I don't know, boiled down, distilled into the tightest package that I could make. But this story centers these three siblings who are living in a deep, deep future. But this deep future isn't like the futures that you maybe are imagining. This future looks a lot more like the distant human past. This is a future where it's so far forward that the people are living in the environment that we've left them, and they don't know anything about us. They still, however, tell some stories that might be familiar to us. So, you know, they tell stories about, for instance, these two brothers learning to fly like birds. And if you're reading carefully, you might think, oh, I wonder if that's the Wright brothers. They tell stories about the sun dropping a bead of light onto an island and destroying the island, right? And if you're reading carefully, you might think, oh, I wonder if that's the atomic bomb. So they are telling some stories that echo back to our time, but they don't know anything about us. And these three siblings who've grown up in a fishing village that might be like in coastal Oregon, for instance, come into contact with someone from an entirely different culture. This is someone who has grown up in a position of privilege within this Bronze Age civilization that is in our deep future. People have relearned how to melt copper and tin together and create bronze, and that's given these people advantages just like it did 3,000 years ago. It was really fun to follow these siblings and then see how their journey interacts with the journey of this privileged person from that Bronze Age culture, and to sort of see the sparks that were created when they came together. But maybe my favorite part of writing the book was trying to imagine how sort of the wisest people in this book would tell the story about what happened in the mistake that extractive cultures make. The Bronze Age culture is an extractive culture. Western civilization in general is an extractive culture. And extractive cultures throughout history make the same mistake over and over and over, and it causes their collapse over and over and over. It's so clear. And so here's the story, sort of the allegory maybe, of how the smart people in this book reflect on that mistake. Once there was a river hemmed in by the labor of men, this greatest achievement to subdue a river. On leveled channels, he built his houses, temples, and monuments. On drained wetlands, he grew gardens too vast to tend alone. The river stayed a river. Born from dark cracks on distant slopes, bending around every obstruction, each drop together a serpent across the valley floor, cutting silt and later mud and then downed wood before drought and winds again return the river to carving sand. Ceaseless and never sleeping, the river stays a river. Yet once men commanded other men to lay stones, to bolster those shores, to contain the ceaseless for simple purpose. When the river undercut his stones, he brought more. When the river flooded over top, he brought taller stones. But for these, the river only flowed faster and hit the far bank and flooded that land. More stones, man thought. I said I can subdue a river. Some began to say the stones weren't working, that they would never work. Bags of sand would do. So many bags of sand, shoveling and stacking. The river, it stayed a river. Some said the stones and bags were the problem. They said to dig channels, to steal flow from where it was needed. This brilliant advancement that brought water to new fields. Yet the river stayed a river. Collapsing dikes, dams, houses, and monuments and temples swept away. 60 days of rain to make a monster. 60 of sunlight to make again a gentle ford. Mounds of rubble littered the floodplain, a wasteland left to ripen under the summer sun, fertile ground for those who will nurture crops. Together, we are the ancients' grateful children. Hear them singing, every tool you need you have in excess. Do not fight water, ride it.
Beautiful. That was definitely one of the passages that I was hoping that you might choose, so thank you for that. But actually, let's jump right into deep time, because that's one of the core themes of the book, and it really resonated with me. Not only is it in this book, it's something I've been thinking about previously, and also coincidentally, I'm reading a couple other sci-fi trilogies that deal with these like monumental timescales, societal collapse, regrowth, etc. And so it's really been swirling around in my head. I've actually grown a little conflicted about taking refuge in that perspective of deep time, though. What does it mean to you to think about that and to have spent so much of the last several years, you know, writing this book that really focuses on it? What do you think that we have to learn from that?
I think the main takeaway for me is just how resilient planet Earth is and just how resilient the human animal is. I'll give you a real specific example. I was looking at interglacial periods throughout Earth's history, reading up on the science, like what causes the climate to shift, what causes, you know, carbon to increase its quantity in the atmosphere on a natural level. How often does this happen? What were humans doing during these periods in the past? And I stumbled upon this one situation that is really the reason you and I are here right now. And it has to do with climate change that happened 200,000 years ago. The Earth didn't heat, it cooled. And when it cooled, the atmospheric water diminished and the world entered a really prolonged drought of about 50,000 years, much longer than the typical span of like an ice age, right? This is a very long ice age. Human populations at this time, there were, we know of kind of six, quote, species of humans. They weren't probably species. They were probably better thought of as races of humans across the Earth. The Neanderthals are the most famous. But the humans that we're most related to were living in Africa. And we seem to have been living on the plains for the most part. But as Africa became a dunescape, as the water dried up and Africa became a dunescape, we were pressed to the coastlines. And as we reached the coastlines, we had to change the way we lived. At one point, 150,000 years ago, on the southern tip of Africa, it seems, though it may be the east side of Africa, but it was a very small area, wherever it was, we humans figured something out. So we're living in these, what we think of as refugia along the coasts of Africa. And at one point, our population seemed to have condensed a lot. All of us alive today, no matter where we live, every one of us is related to, it appears from genetic analysis, just 300 individuals. I'm not saying that only 300 people were alive on Earth, not at all, but all of us that are alive today are related to just 300 people. These 300 people figured something out. We know they figured something out because they went from humans before this period were living in family groups of up to 50. After this period, humans are living in groups that transcend family, and it pretty quickly get into thousands of individuals. And like any species, you know, the more individuals you have working in cohesive harmony, the better you are at surviving. And that appears to be the reason why these modern humans who then left Africa were able to thrive in places the Neanderthals had failed and other humans were failing in other parts of the world. It's because we could work together in bigger groups. The advantage was probably story. We figured out how to tell stories and we united ourselves around story. But back to your question about deep time, I thought that was just an interesting event, like a really fascinating event. But then, you know, weeks, months later, I was looking at worst case scenarios of human-caused climate change in the future, 5,000 years. What do the Earth's biomes look like in 5,000 years under different degrees of warming? And that science is always changing. It's being updated as we better understand climate change. But at the worst case scenario, let's say 8 degrees Celsius warming, which some scientists think we probably can't reach because we won't be able to pollute that hard that long before things collapse. But if we warm the world to 8 degrees Celsius in about 5,000 years, the Earth, it starts to look like dunes, like, you know, deserts. North and South America are largely a dunescape. And I saw models of North and South America. I saw models of Africa. And for just a second, my brain was like, oh yeah, that's 200,000 years ago. And then I was like, oh no, that's actually the future in a worst case scenario. And then I thought, wow, if that's the worst case scenario in the future and humans survived the same kind of dunescape without technologies like chickens and agriculture, what are we all worried about? Right? Obviously, we have a lot to be worried about. And I think that's what you're talking about when you say you have, you know, you feel two ways about thinking in deep time.
Yeah.
The danger of thinking about deep time is you're like, ah, whatever, you know, like we're not going to die off or we are going to die off, but it's deep time. It doesn't matter from that perspective. Deep time can do that. It can make you feel like none of this matters. But what I took away from it was this message of, dang, humans are really good at surviving. And the animals humans care about, we are really good at helping them survive too. That gives me a lot of hope even now, you know, years after that sort of realization. That's something I come back to all the time personally, psychologically, to help me, you know, settle when I get bad news about the climate that's really, you know, making me feel terrible about the future. I come back to that idea of resilience.
I really agree and resonate with what you're saying there. And you are right that that is my conflict with it, is I really do find a lot of solace when I can connect with that sense of how small and fleeting this life is. At the same time, I want to stay angry enough to fight for what we have now. So that's just a tension for me. But I do think that when we're really going through it, it is important always to kind of step back and say, look, we've been here before, as you talk about in the book. As anybody who is even fleetingly aware of the genocide of Native Americans and their amazing refusal to give in to this genocidal campaign and now the like kind of flourishing of Native American cultures again, like can take inspiration from that. But yeah, that's where I have that kind of internal conflict.
Yeah, well, amen to staying, you know, fired up enough to fight for the immediate changes that are within reach, mm-hmm. right? And to fight for these places that are so valuable to us. In taking the broad perspective on climate change, you know, I definitely did not want any reader to sort of leave the book thinking, oh, we don't have to do anything.
Yeah.
And hopefully at the end of the book, people have a sense of like what they can do, you know, to help the people around them, to help the world around them. And hopefully that, you know, the book does leave readers with that kind of perspective rather than the nihilist perspective.
I kind of want to come back to a couple pieces of this book and yes. also want to cover another book of yours that I absolutely loved, a very different book called Whiskey When We're Dry, and you referenced it earlier. I love that book so much. It is heartbreaking, emotional. It's a Western, which I always have a soft spot for, but it's got this amazing young female protagonist, and it's like such a fun read as well. So could you talk a little bit about Whiskey When We're Dry?
Oh, I'd love to. Jess, the protagonist of that book, is still dear to my heart. We hung out together every day for years, and now I never get to see her. So any chance to sort of, you know, connect with her again. Yeah, so Whiskey When We're Dry, that was born, sort of the underlying emotions of that book was I grew up reading Westerns. That was the only kind of book that men read in my family. And so, you know, as a teenager, I didn't read sci-fi or fantasy. I read, you know, my dad and uncle's Westerns. And I hated them. You know, I loved the landscape. I loved the dichotomy between good and evil that was so clear cut. What I didn't like, you know, and I came to understand this as I aged, was the John Wayne element of the Western. And so this voice appeared in my ear, and maybe a few weeks into the process of writing the book, I realized, oh my gosh, this is the Western I want to read. And so I think of it as being at war with the myths that we carry about the settlement, quote unquote, of the American West, in the same way that I think about the ancients being sort of at war with the conceptions that are dominant about climate change right now, the myths we tell ourselves about climate change. And I'm starting to realize that's kind of my approach to writing my best fiction, is I need to be kind of at war with dominant ideas that I disagree with in some way.
I didn't even think of it as strongly as you being at war with the classic Western tropes, as respectfully updating them, because I also grew up reading a lot of Westerns, and I love Westerns, but yes, so many of them are just almost unreadable to our modern like sensibilities, and really should have been. Some of them should have been unreadable even when they were written. But yeah, I love that book. And I read in a previous interview that you were working on a follow-up of sorts to Whiskey When We're Dry. So please tell me that's real.
I did. I wrote a follow-up to it, and I have it. It just needs more. It needs more from me. It was too derivative, and it's not quite its own work yet, but it's still there.
So I wanted to go back to the ancients for a minute, if we could. In reading the book and in actually some of what you've said in this conversation, you've brought up the concept of living in balance with nature, living within the constraints of nature. I would say from a values perspective, I share that. I definitely try to reject the most crass forms of my consumerist impulses, et cetera. Also, having worked in politics, so you're touching on themes that are at least adjacent to, say, like the degrowth movement that a lot of folks might be familiar with. And that movement holds a lot of, like I say, like values affinity for me politically. It's basically a recipe for more of the fascism we're getting today. at least in the short term, right? And so, you know, there's this countercurrent among serious people who want to deal with climate change and issues of equity and justice. And that's kind of that like abundance mindset and the abundance movement of kind of basically growing our way out of this. I'm curious what you think about that tension around that. And this isn't necessarily your responsibility to have a political hat, but it's something that just like as somebody who's worked in politics, that's always part of my calculus around how we work a way out of this.
I would argue that that dichotomy that you describe between the grow our way out and the degrow, you know, or shrink ourselves away from this problem is a red herring. And that the real problem is in the phrasing of the idea that we can live in, quote, harmony with nature, or we can, quote, not live in harmony with nature. I don't think that's true. I think we are absolutely nature, period. Hard stop. We are living in harmony with nature. Our culture is extracting more resources right now than that nature can regenerate. We're doing it faster than we're taking more gifts than can be returned to us. What we're essentially doing is living large right now in a way that means that fewer of us can live in the future. That's how I see it.
Yeah.
The harmony is here. It's coming. There's no way around it. If you believe humans are an animal, then you are absolutely accepting the fact, I see it as a fact, that harmony will be restored in the same way that it has been restored throughout planet Earth in our short time here watching biomes. We watch one species push its populations too large. They experience trouble. Those populations contract. That's going to happen to us. Our current culture may have created a major population boom, but this isn't a caring capacity that's sustainable. We all understand that.
Well, definitely some people would disagree with that.
I'm talking on the scale of 10,000 years, right? So yeah, the people who are saying we can grow ourselves out of this problem, the issue is this fundamental story that all of these technologies are growing out of has as its basic tenet, humans are outside of nature. We can live outside the harmony of nature. I don't think we can. I think if you believe humans are animals, then you'll eventually come around to accept that, no, we are actually in harmony with nature. We're just pretending we're not.
Yeah, I guess, this is fascinating. I need to, again, think on whether the story of like an abundance mindset leading us out of the climate crisis is incompatible with that or not, you know, because I think about learning to more fully harness solar, wind, wave energies as a way of not only growing the energy capacity for people around the world, but also in a way that's kind of reharmonizing our relationship. I think maybe there's room for both in that story of more and abundance, because in the same way that it's hard to grasp the scale of the climate crisis, it's hard to grasp the scale of the need and desire of people all over the world to live up to our standards, or at least the standards of Europe in terms of, you know, material abundance, food abundance. And so do you think those stories are compatible?
I think not. I think that what we're likely to see over the next 50 years, over our lifetimes, as we bring on more renewable energy forms, we're not going to see our carbon footprint decrease. And the reason we're not is because we're going to continue to grow. Hard stop. We're going to continue to grow. And yeah, we might have more efficient energy, but we're going to see our carbon footprint increasing. What's going to stop that carbon footprint from increasing is the simple fact that the changing environment is going to make it harder to get the commodities reliably that system's dependent on. And maybe inside 50 years, we're going to see that actually unraveling. Maybe it'll take longer. Maybe it'll take 150 years. In the unraveling period, as this story that we're all living in, the story that says we are apart from nature and that we can live outside of harmony of nature, as that story unravels, there's going to be a lot of hardship for people.
I'm not saying that you're wrong. I fear that you may be right, because I do see that future as very possible. And I see the future that I'm sort of talking about. I mean, especially with the authoritarian currents circulating all over the world right now. I see that the future that I'm describing, this sort of abundance economy, abundance movement, as just an invisibly narrow path. But as a way of bringing us to the next point, I'll say I personally have to currently believe that there is a path forward to bring a modicum of the comforts that we enjoy to people around the world. Otherwise, I think that there is a much bleaker future ahead than the one that exists if we did drastically increase our renewable energy footprint. But before we wrap up, I want to know if there's anything we've missed. And I know we've missed a lot. There's so much more that we could talk about all the beautiful characters in your stories. But what do you want to make sure really gets included in this conversation that we haven't touched on yet?
I think what feels important to me is that the Western civilization story that we all, you know, live within teaches us that humans have to manage everything. I would argue that the management can itself create a lot of problems. In fact, climate change may be what happens after generations of trying to manage small problems. And that humans, as an animal, might be better off when we start riding the water instead of trying to control the water.
Before I let you go, where can people find your work? What's your website? How do you want people to engage with these books?
My website's just my name, johnlarrison.com. And boy, when you buy a book from an independent bookstore, 40% of the money you spend stays local instead of going to Jeff Bezos. And the author actually gets a big vote of confidence from that. The publisher notices that in a way they don't notice Amazon sales. And it helps authors stay in the business of writing. So whenever possible, try to support your local booksellers. You're really doing a good thing for writers, for the booksellers themselves, and for your local community.
Well, once again, those books are The Ancients, Whiskey When We're Dry. There's others that I haven't read yet, but I can't wait to. So, John Larrison, thank you so much for joining us on Coast Range Radio.
Thanks so much for having me. This has been a great time.
And that's it for this episode of Coast Range Radio. If you like the show, please help me grow the audience. Tell your friends about it. Follow Coast Range Radio on social media, even though we hate social media.